Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Dick Staub, and I want to welcome you to the Kindling's Muse at the Movies, intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter in today's movies. Over the next few minutes, we're going to discuss some current releases, a few new DVD releases, and with summer almost upon us, hard to believe, we're going to talk about some of the upcoming picks of our panel as we look ahead to the summer movies. We're joined by Jeffrey Overstreet, film critic, author of Aurelia's Colors and Through a Screen Darkly, Jenny Spohr, film producer, producer of The Kindling's Muse, and a reviewer with Pass the Popcorn, and Greg White, otherwise known as Greg Wright, managing editor of HollywoodJesus.com, Pass the Popcorn, and a million other things. Good to have you all with us today.
I've been called worse things, Dick.
Greg is
white or right?
He is white.
White is right, and he is white. There we go. And Jeffrey, update on the writing. Aurelia's Colors is part one.
Yeah, part one's going well. It just went into a second printing.
Excellent.
Part two comes out in September and still needs to be proofread. And part three is in my head, very anxious to get onto the paper.
Woohoo!
So thank you for asking.
That's great. Well, today we're going to start with some movies that are in the theater. And Jenny, we're going to start with you, Iron Man.
Iron Man. Iron Man is the most top rated action hero movie of, well, Rotten Tomatoes history, I guess. I'm looking on there. It is got a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is, of course, the website where all the reviewers go in and add their 2 cents. And I went in with that expectation watching this movie, Iron Man, and unfortunately, it didn't quite live up to what I thought. It is, for those of you who don't know, Iron Man is the story of Tony Stark, who's a very rich socialite who owns a weapons manufacturing company and is sort of a playboy of the world. And he is captured in Afghanistan and creates this iron bodysuit to get him out of his captivity. Then comes home and grows a heart and realizes we shouldn't all blow each other up. So he makes a better suit. So he still has the biggest toy and the biggest weapon and is still blowing people up, but somehow that all comes out in the wash. And it is fun. It's Robert Downey Jr. plays Tony Stark, and he's witty and funny, and there's great dialogue. It really is a fun sit back, eat your popcorn, entertaining summer
movie.
So
why were you disappointed with it?
I was hoping it would have some depth, some sort of profundity to it. You know, when you watch, say, Batman Begins, for example, that's an artistic film that has depth to it, but yet it's still a fun, entertaining blockbuster action hero movie.
Yeah.
So I was hoping for a little bit of that going into Iron Man, just because it was rated so highly.
Now let's turn to
really
the guys
bad.
Who guys don't typically look for depth, probably very satisfied. What'd you guys think of it?
Well, I actually was very pleasantly surprised by it, because I see, you know, some hope and a trend developing in the summer movies this year where they're not quite as dark, not quite as complex and overly plotted as, you know, the bloat of the summer of 2007. I just sat down and rewatched Dead Man's Chest again the other day, you know, and that's sort of the epitome of overdone.
Yeah.
And while I personally like that film an awful lot, something like Iron Man for a summer movie is like a breath of fresh air, because it's simple, to the point, makes its statements about certain issues, you know, about having a conscience and then doing something about it, in a very simple, straightforward way, and you don't have to worry about keeping track of multi-levels of plot and who's double-crossing whom and who is who and blah, 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 blah. It's just good, straightforward entertainment. A lot like the summer movies we used to see back in the 80s. That's what it felt like to me. It was a very 1980s summer movie.
Interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot, too. I wouldn't say I was disappointed, because I guess I wasn't expecting much, but Robert Downey Jr., it never would have occurred to me to have him play an action hero like this. And it's such a great idea, and he does it so beautifully. He's so funny. Gwyneth Paltrow, it was such a treat to see her again, and somehow she's mysteriously reversing the aging process. She looks younger than she did in Shakespeare in Love many years ago. What disappointed me a little bit about the film was it started with this sort of spacious kind of storytelling where they had room to play and have all these spontaneous things happen. And then it really narrowed to the typical one robot versus a bigger, badder robot at the end, or man in suit. And that was a little disappointing. Even more disappointing is the idea that it raises this question about, you know, is it such a good idea to build up all this weaponry and turn that loose in the world? And then the man with the conscience comes up with a great solution. Build a suit full of weaponry and go out and clean up the mess. And that's a problem. I'm not sure that all comes out in the wash at the end, I'd say. But they do a good job of kind of covering that problem with it.
Okay, well, let's move on to standard operating procedure. Greg.
This is the latest of Errol Morris's documentary. And for those who don't know, he has an incredibly profound history in documentary filmmaking. Made a couple of small films first and then made a big splash while researching another documentary called The Thin Blue Line back in 1988 that was pretty groundbreaking in a lot of respects. First in the techniques that it used, it was bold enough to use reenactments in a documentary, which, you know, we see a lot on the History Channel these days, done very badly. But back in those days, you know, documentaries didn't do that sort of thing. Errol Morris explains that by saying that what he tries to do with his documentaries is to get at the truth. And that one did. The subject of the film, Randall Dale Adams, who was on death row in Texas, because of Errol Morris's film, was freed because it was determined that somebody else committed the murder, as Morris rightly suspected. Abu Ghraib is the subject of standard operating procedure, and this film does not have quite that impact. Errol Morris does not look at what happened at Abu Ghraib and come up with some smoking gun or some new theory about, you know, these people really didn't do it, somebody else did, or whatever. And the truth that he gets at, I don't think, is all that terribly profound in the story itself, which is, by the way, if you just look at those photographs, there's a lot more to the story there than what you see. Now, while that's true, that's just not terribly profound. However, what is profound about standard operating procedure and why I recommend it, even though I wouldn't even place it in the top 10 documentaries I've seen in the last year, is because of the context that Errol Morris puts it in. Last month, he wrote a series of articles for the New York Times in which he talks in great detail about the art form of documentary filmmaking. And naturally, because of his stature, got a number of other documentary filmmakers to chime in the comments on those posts in the New York Times. And I really recommend everybody look those up and read through them. Because what this film does in the context of that discussion is teach us an awful lot about our expectations as a movie-going public, not only about documentaries, but about films in general. He says some things in the New York Times that's worth quoting. He says, "There is no mode of expression, no technique of production that will instantly produce truth or falsehood. There is no veritas lens, no lens that provides a truthful picture of events. There is cinema verite and kino pravda, but no cinematic truth. The engine of uncovering truth is not some special lens or even the unadorned human eye. It is unadorned human reason."
Oh my gosh.
And his point is that we have to be critically engaging what we see when we go to see films. One of the things he closes off with is a statement that's incredibly powerful. "If seeing is believing, then we better be damn careful about what we show other people, including ourselves, because regardless of what it is, we are likely to uncritically believe it." And he goes into a lot of detail about the science and psychology behind ocular perception.
In other words, he loves YouTube.
Well, I tell you, it has, there's a lot of implications to this.
Oh, totally.
Because we are such a visually oriented and visually driven culture, and yet we really don't think all that deeply about the things that we put in front of us, which is much to our shame, I think.
Yeah.
And there are very few filmmakers that I think really deal with that in a very honest and straightforward manner. I think Errol Morris is one of those and worth paying attention to on the subject. And standard operating procedure is a good case study because, for instance, some of the things you find out is that even though you think you may think you know everything about what happened at Abu Ghraib because of the photos that were published, you don't, because almost all of those photos came from essentially one cell block in a prison of 10,000 people, and were all shot within a space of 4 months in a very narrow window of opportunity. Yeah. So there were a lot of other things going on there, and you might start asking questions about what those other things were. So there's not the whole story being told. And, of course, Morris doesn't even get at it himself.
Interesting.
But it raises, the movie and the context for discussion raises incredibly important moral issues, obviously, because of what we did at Abu Ghraib, and also about the art form itself.
But, you know, what I love about what you're saying and reporting that he's saying is that film has a redemptive potential when it's in the hands of filmmakers who are thoughtful, who are not just creative, but who are actually thinking and reasoning and trying to find ways of communicating something that matters.
Well, I think I would make an analogy with a knife. If you put a knife in the hands of the wrong people, it can do horrible things. But if it's used the way it was intended, knives can do wonderful things for us. I think, unfortunately, my opinion is the vast majority of the movie-going public doesn't really know what to do with knives.
Interesting.
And they use them poorly.
Jeffrey, you wanted to talk about The Visitor.
The Visitor, I've been waiting for a new film from Tom McCarthy for a long time. Thomas McCarthy made a movie called The Station Agent, which when I saw it the first time, I thought it was a sweet little movie about three delightful characters. It has become the DVD in my collection that I loan out the most.
Really?
It's a quiet little story about a man who inherits a little train depot, sort of an abandoned station in the middle of nowhere next to a railroad track, and he moves in because he wants to get away from everybody else. And then a fellow opens an espresso stand right next to the depot, and little by little, our hero, Finn, is drawn out of his self-induced isolation and forced into community, and we learn about the role of community in our lives and the importance of relationships. All of that to say that, surprise, surprise, The Visitor is about a very quiet, reserved man who has isolated himself from the rest of the world and who, while he is a professor in Connecticut, is really just closing down his mind, his dreams, his ambitions. He just wants to be left alone. He's grieving the death of his wife, a concert violinist, if I remember correctly. And what happens is this. He goes to a conference in New York, opens up an apartment that he has there that he hasn't seen in a long time, comes to find out that there are two illegal immigrants living in the apartment there. And he kicks them out right away, but of course he'll be drawn into their lives. And as he is, he comes to understand their plight, develops compassion for them, their situation. One is from Syria, the other is from Senegal. And his love of music wakes up again when he discovers that Tarek, the man of the couple, plays the djembe and is part of a drum circle down in the park. And so he becomes a part of that. And it's just this wonderful story of watching a character wake up. And the reason this is such a great movie about immigration and the issues on the table right now is that it isn't about immigration. Mm-hmm. It's about characters. And so the story raises these questions with subtlety and integrity without shoving an issue in your face. And so at the end, you're left thinking about this particular story, and it's beautifully acted, especially by Richard Jenkins, who finally has a leading role and has deserved one for a long time.
From Six Feet Under.
Yes, yes, and many of the Coen Brothers films. And
right.
I think this film does right what, and I know a lot of people disagree with me on this one, but what Alexander Payne's About Schmidt did wrong. Mm-hmm. About Schmidt was so scornful and sarcastic about its characters that it really didn't play fair. And this film, I don't think McCarthy is capable of disliking any of his characters. There's a compassionate eye that he sees with and that he encourages us to see with. And that, I think, is a great form of storytelling.
Did you want to add anything to that, Greg?
Well, I enjoyed it tremendously, too. The comparison that I made was the film that I saw 2 weeks prior to this that's very much about the same sorts of things in some ways, Smart People. Because, again, at the center of that story was a character played by Dennis Quaid, who is a cynical college professor who has things to learn from people. But, again, like Jeffrey said, this is a film that does write what a lot of things, other films like perhaps Smart People and About Schmidt do wrong, because it's the compassion for the characters, compassion on the people. And I was also very surprised by a lot of the reviewers who said that it was an issue film and that the immigration thing overwhelmed the story. And I was like, did we see the same film? Because I did not feel that way at all. I thought it was a very, very moving and personal story about one man's particular struggle. And also found it to be a really wonderful romance story between two mature adult leads. that didn't have to pander to the conventions that we have of films about romances.
Right, and actually had an integrity that stayed through the way the story ends, which was kind of cool. This was a Sundance film, and just as Jeffrey was waiting for the next film from this guy, that's the Sundance storyline that happened. People wanted to see this film, lined up to see this film. An example of the kind of thoughtful films that happens at Sundance. I really enjoyed it myself. We're going to move on now to some DVDs that are out in new release, and Jenny's going to get us started with I'm Not There.
I'm Not There is a film, an experimental film, and it studies the life, if you can study the life, of Bob Dylan. And that is sort of the argument it makes. You kind of can't study the life of Bob Dylan, so you have to do it experimentally. They use 6 different actors, none of whom look at all like Bob Dylan, one of them being Cate Blanchett, who did the Oscar-worthy performance there. Amazing. But you follow these 6 different characters who are bringing out a different aspect of Bob Dylan's life or something that he is interested in. And they never interact with each other, but they're always spliced throughout the film. I mean, because it's experimental, you're not having a narrative flow, and people criticize it because of that, but they don't understand experimental film. So you're following these different tidbits of Dylan's life, and it deals with questions of art, the artist, politics, role models, icons, faith, truth, all of these different things that Dylan has obviously wrestled with in his songs. The filmmaker is wrestling with as well. I'm not a big Bob Dylan fan, so I don't know much of his life. And so watching the film gave me a different dimension, thinking, you know, what of this is true and what of this is not, as far as, you know, quotes around true. What are these actual events in his life? I mean, I knew when Dylan went electric, it's that, you know, those are in the movie, and I knew those parts, but there were some things like he loved the Old West, and Richard Gere sort of plays this Billy the Kid type character as Dylan, and that was completely confusing to me because I didn't realize that Bob Dylan loved the Old West. So I think a Dylan fan will go bonzo for this movie. Right. I mean, they would just love it.
But the other thing about Dylan, though, is he has had a longevity. He spans so many kind of movements within American life, you know, over the last 50 years, that even if you're not a Dylan fan, if you're all interested in what's been happening in our country, thematically, you get it a lot.
Exactly. And
what would you guys add to this film?
Well, his songwriting is all about history, too. And so while his life spans an important period, his songwriting expands that even more.
Yeah.
I mean, the first character we encounter, and each version of Dylan in this movie has his own name, his own personality, his own history. So we never really get Dylan. We get characters who represent aspects of Dylan. Marcus Carl Franklin is an 11-year-old African-American singer who plays Woody, and that represents, in a way, Bob Dylan's devotion to the art and the songs of Woody Guthrie. And that gives you one angle on what Dylan loved, but also a way of exploring the musical traditions that Dylan was traveling there. Of course, Cate Blanchett is firmly anchored in a particular chapter of Dylan's own life, but still, she has her own name. She plays a character named Jude Quinn, who goes through a lot of the same controversies that Dylan did when he left the folk music audience feeling abandoned and switched to rock. But another important player in this movie is Bruce Greenwood, who plays another timeless character who seems to drift through the years in different guises, and that is sort of the enemy, who is often the press or the media or whoever is in power trying to pin Dylan down and explain him to the public. And every time he tries, he fails, and Dylan turns against him. And often in a song, Dylan will show him up as being a fool, and the critic, unable to understand the song, just stands there smugly. My favorite scene in the film is a performance of a Dylan song where Blanchett is just scorning the critic at the back of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And the film runs a little long because it has so many ideas packed into it, but Todd Haynes is an incredible director, and I think this is the finest thing he's done yet.
Hmm.
One of the funner parts for the movie for me is just that there's so much quotable stuff in it. I mean, if you wanted to quote mine it for an 8,000 word review, you could go on, you know, indefinitely. I just said in my review, there's a lot going on in this film, and not in any literalized way, as Woody smart-aleckly observes. If you're expecting any kind of a clear statement, all you'll really get is something like Quinn's one-word reply, ocelot.
That's true.
It's
okay,
fun.
Okay, let's
fun.
Move on to Baron Munchausen.
Yeah.
And Jeff, you're going to start us off on that one.
Well, I've been wondering why there isn't a good DVD of The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and there finally is, but this film came out in the late 80s. Director Terry Gilliam of Monty Python fame had already become notorious for what's often described as a masterpiece, Brazil.
Yeah.
That was a movie that was a disaster in that the studio wanted to dump it because they didn't understand it, and critics really saved Brazil. They started demanding that this movie be released because they saw it at secret screenings, and made Gilliam sort of a cult hero for moviegoers. So then the studios gave Gilliam a lot of money, and he went out and made this film about this great folk hero, Baron Munchausen, this figure who represents imagination and whimsy and childlike faith. But like Don Quixote again, Gilliam overran his budget, and it became one of the biggest financial fiascos in Hollywood history. And when the film was released, it was poorly promoted. Very few people saw it. But I still think it's a masterpiece. I think it's maybe the film that's closest to Gilliam's heart or what he's always trying to do in a movie, which is explore that mysterious area between the imagination's ability to take us out of reality and the imagination's ability to enhance and illuminate reality.
What happened with the audience? They just weren't ready for it? They couldn't get it?
I don't think very many people even saw it because it was poorly promoted.
I happen to be one of those few people in
the theater. What were your thoughts when you originally saw it and now when you reflect back on it?
Well, I was familiar with Gilliam and his oeuvre, as it were, and had seen Brazil, so I had something of an idea of what to expect. So it didn't, I didn't find it all that off putting, but it's unconventional, and if you were going to see, even something as silly as Monty Python and the Holy Grail has something that looks like a real story to it.
Yeah.
But with Munchausen, it was just, it was so all over the place and abstract, and in a lot of ways, about a lot of the same things that Errol Morris talks about when talking about documentary films. It's hard to get a handle on, I think, for a lot of audiences. I haven't seen it since it originally came out in the theater, so I wouldn't attempt to assess its place in the critical pantheon at this point without seeing it again. But I strongly suspect that there is probably a lot more going on in what they call a meta way in it than the vast majority of films that you see today. It is a film about filmmaking.
Is there supplemental material in the DVD you're getting a lot of backstory?
Finally, there is. There's a documentary about all the stuff that went on behind the scenes. There's a commentary with Gilliam. But it's also really fun to watch because it stars Sarah Polley, the director of Away From Her, which starred Julie Christie this last year. She stars in this as the little girl who tags along with Baron Munchausen. She was only 9 years old.
Wow.
And it's wonderful to see that. Robin Williams has one of his more outrageous appearances on screen, and if you know his career, that's saying something. Yeah. Uma Thurman, I believe, was introduced in this film, or at least it came out right at the same time as Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah.
And she plays a goddess, appropriately. And Jonathan Pryce, who was the hero of Brazil, is the villain this time around. There's even a memorable little cameo from Sting. So there are so many surprising little appearances along the way and magnificent special effects. Yes, it is abstract, but I don't think it's ever boring.
Okay, Steel City, real quickly, DVD release.
This is a small film that about 12 people saw when it was released in the theaters last year. It's, I think, one of the finest dramas I've seen in a long, long, long time, and I'm really glad it's out on DVD now because it'll give a lot of people an opportunity to see it that never would have had a chance with a small theatrical release like it had. The basic story is that John Hurd plays an alcoholic, and he and his son have been involved in a car accident where somebody has been killed. And John Hurd goes to prison for vehicular homicide because there was alcohol involved. And the story is really a very, very personal drama about this man and the relationship between his two sons, one of whom is estranged, and his brother, Vic, who serves as a surrogate father for these two boys when he's in prison. And it is, in short, one of the most redemptive stories I have ever seen on film. Goes in directions you can't possibly expect it to. So don't even try guessing. It'll throw some surprises at you. But it's just an incredibly poignant, small drama. John Hurd makes such excellent, excellent choices in his materials. Anytime you can see his name attached to something, you can be guaranteed that it's got something worthwhile in it.
One of the things that I love about you guys, all male and female guys, choosing these films is how often you open with, this is a film nobody saw and everybody should have. And this podcast becomes kind of a place where people can make their Netflix list of all those classics that they may not have even heard of that would be worth taking another look at. Let's talk real quick about some of the summer films coming out as we're looking ahead, this being May the 12th or something like that, May 13th. What is today? but what are we looking forward to this summer?
Well, there's
who
some
wants to get us started?
There's some really fun stuff coming out. I'm really looking forward to seeing WALL-E, which is the Pixar follow-up from Ratatouille last year. It's not about rats. It's about a robot this time. But Pixar just does such great work. And just looking at the trailer for this, it looks like a sweet, fun family film again that I just think is going to do great in the box office. It really is sort of the only family summer blockbuster kind of coming out. I mean, last year you had, you know, at least the Simpsons movie, and then, you know, some of these other sort of cartoon movies, but this year is certainly one of the finest, if not one of the only ones coming out. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
Can I add to that? Yeah, I just heard from a good friend and colleague, Stephen Gradonis, who was at Comic-Con. He saw some footage there that hadn't been revealed anywhere else yet, and he said his hopes skyrocketed, which is appropriate for this film. He said, "I haven't felt awe and wonder at at what I see on the big screen like that to compare since 2001: A Space Odyssey."
Wow!
So it sounds like just when we think Pixar can't do any better, they blow us away with something new. Huh. So I can't wait.
Huh. What else?
Well, there's a lot on the list. One I'm particularly interested in seeing, not for any spirituality whatsoever, but just because I've never been quite as impressed by Steve Carell as everybody else has, I think. I've been waiting for the film to come along where I think he finally will do exactly what everybody says he's been doing all along, and I haven't seen. And I'm hoping Get Smart is it, because I think it's, I'm serious, I think it's a great fit for him.
Jenny's going to be disappointed with the intellectual content.
It will be. I can guarantee it will be shallow. Absolutely.
As a huge fan of the show, probably the only one at this table that actually saw it when it was... Well, you might have, Greg.
Absolutely. I watched it nonstop when I was a kid. Yeah. But, you know, this is summer entertainment. You know, I guarantee that the fourth Indiana Jones movie is not going to be any wealth of depth either. I'm pretty sure of that.
Right.
But there are lots of these films that I think will be interesting and looking forward to. Also, The X-Files and The Happening, M. Night Shyamalan. That guy's latest film.
Yeah. But are we tired of his formula after he announced that he had the formula and every film he made was going to be incredible?
Well, see, I think people give him kind of a bad rap. I mean, The Sixth Sense was a phenomenal film.
Yes, it was.
And you kind of can't remake that movie. Yeah. You got to try for something else. And I felt like if nobody had seen The Sixth Sense or The Village was someone else's movie, it would have gotten better reviews. I loved The Village. And I think Lady in the Water, I didn't see, but was certainly panned. I'm hoping The Happening can kind of bring back a little bit more of his magic. So
I think Unbreakable, personally, I think Unbreakable is his best film. I like Sixth Sense a lot, and I think the conclusion of Unbreakable is a little bit of a stumble, but that's the one I go back to again and again. I would like to see him direct someone else's script for a change.
Yes.
I think he's been pumping out stories so quickly that character development has suffered, and although he still gets the thrills and the jumps, but I'd like to see him find a really good script by somebody else. So for a while, it was rumored that he was going to direct the adaptation of Life of Pi, and then that fell through. So I'm
or perhaps
that'll happen.
See somebody else direct one of his scripts.
Maybe.
What about you, Jeffrey? What are you looking forward to this summer?
Well, I am counting down the days, and there are only six now, till I see a sneak preview of Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Raiders of the Lost Ark is my favorite adventure film of all time, probably in my top five movies of all time. It never disappoints me. I thought it might this last Saturday night, and it didn't again, because it does so much the old-fashioned way. It does so much with handmade effects, with real stunts, with scenes that let the camera just sit and observe something as it plays out instead of all the fast cutting that makes you lose faith in what you're seeing. Harrison Ford, there's never been a better actor-character match than Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones. There's never been an Indiana Jones girlfriend better than Marion, and who actually had some substance in that film. And I'm glad they're bringing her back for this one. It looks like this could be just a really fun throwback, just sort of a tribute to that kind of movie making. But I think Spielberg's learned a lot since then. It'll be interesting to see what he's able to accomplish in this without George Lucas ruining it, because he's said he's said in
we're
in
going
interviews
after Smallion and George Lucas.
Yeah, well, he said in interviews that he wanted it to be a whole lot wackier, and that's gives me the jitters. So I have high hopes for it, and we'll see what see what happens.
Anything else, real quick? Before
yeah,
we wrap
you
up?
Know, I really want to mention. The Batman movie coming out, Dark Knight. I mentioned the Batman Begins earlier, and with Christian Bale and Heath Ledger both starring in this. Of course, Heath Ledger's last film, but it's this has got to be fun, but also got some meat to it, and I'm really excited to see it.
I think I also might mention that even though I'm quite sure that none of us are all that thrilled about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian could be a sleeper. It really could have some good stuff to it, and we'll have to wait and see on that.
I'm a little curious about Hellboy 2, simply because we all know that Del Toro is going to go on to direct The Hobbit and a second Middle-Earth movie, and I think a lot of people are going to be watching Hellboy 2 very closely just to see how high should our hopes be about this guy now that he's taking over for Peter Jackson.
Yeah, interesting. So. Folks, you've been listening to Jeffrey Overstreet, Jenny Spohr, Greg Wright, a lot of interesting films in theaters now, released on DVD, some to look forward to this summer. Thank you for joining us on the Kindlings Muse at the Movies. We'll look forward to seeing you again next time.